Today is Women's Wednesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Women's Wednesday, we focus on all things for and about women.
Today's conversation is likely to upset some folks, but I am sure that you will all recover. Why do I say that? Well, we're talking about the end of male supremacy. If it exists, our author today says it's coming to an end. Allow me to introduce you to today's guest. He is Dr. Melvin Connor. Dr. Connor has been teaching and writing about biological and medical anthropology for over four decades. He is the Samuel Candler Dobbs Professor in the Department of Anthropology and the Program in Neuroscience and Behavioral Biology at Emory University. Clearly, he has a very long business card. Dr. Melvin Connor, welcome to Mind Talk. You have written quite the book.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Now, Dr. Connor, the Mel, the name of your book is really quite interesting. It's eye-catching on a lot of levels. Women After All: Sex, Evolution, and the End of Male Supremacy. So clearly, you know that even in the title, you have caused some folks to sort of their heads to twist around on their shoulders. This is not what folks are used to reading about.
Well, yeah, I have to say that my brilliant wife supplied the title, Women After All, but I've applied the subtitle, and I insisted on cramming in the, you know, I say the book has something to offend everyone, and I think I even got all the groups that are going to be offended into the subtitle. People who are always offended by anything to do with sex, and the people who are always offended by anything to do with evolution, and of course, all the men who don't want to see an end to male privileges.
So you are correct in that you have pretty much offended lots of people right off the bat. So at least folks know what to expect.
Yeah, right.
You say...
I've also offended people who think that there are no actual fundamental biologically related differences between men's and women's minds and brains.
Well, there's so much that you say that... Let's get started with really talking about what you say. You begin by saying that you have a great respect for culture. You recognize that it is a powerful impactor on how people live, but that it does not explain everything.
Yeah, and that's put very well, Pamela. And I think that to prove what I mean about culture, I see culture as the solution, even though to some extent it has in the past been part of the problem.
Right.
And I also think biology has been part of the problem because men and women have different brains. The male brain is more predisposed toward violence and physical aggression, and toward what I call driven sexuality, which is kind of hyper sexuality. I need it now. I got to get it. You know the drill.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a part of the brain that deals with violence and produces violent impulses called the amygdala. It's larger in men. It's very responsive to testosterone, which the men have much more of. And on the other side, and these are results from new brain imaging studies. Women actually have more active inhibition of those violent impulses by the highest part of our brains, which is the frontal lobes. They're more active in women in getting control of those violent impulses coming from the lower parts of the brain. So we know that now.
All right, so clearly, I mean, right from the outset, you are flying in the face of what many people have chosen to believe for a lifetime. You're really asking that retransition from many things, many views that have comforted at least part of our society, and that's the male part of our society. If, in fact, men are superior, which is what, as you know, we've been taught, if men are more able to run countries, make decisions, fill in the blanks, you now want us to transition from that to a thought that women, in fact, have superior skills in those areas. Is that what you're wanting us to do?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I think that has been the prevailing belief, I would say prevailing mythology about male superiority, and it's quite the opposite of the truth, as I think we are increasingly understanding it in anthropology, psychology, behavioral biology, brain science. And the reason is, I mean, what have men said about women, why women shouldn't run countries or fly airplanes or all the rest of it? Women are too emotional, and they're going to be distracted by their emotions.
Right.
And not only that, but the emotions run in monthly cycles. And, you know, none of that is true. On the other side, we have men distracted by their emotions. What more distracting emotions are there than lust and rage? And those are the male distractions. Those are the things that have produced a whole lot of the nasty facts of history. And in recent years, I mean, how many, right, starting with the White House on down to through lots of governors' offices and many other males in power who have abused women, who have taken advantage of women as married men who've had affairs while in office, who've lied about it, who've brought down their governments in a number of cases, and who have caused tremendous distractions and waste of time and money for all of us. That's the male emotional vulnerability that nobody ever talks about.
Well, yeah, and on some levels, even as you're talking about it now, I mean, it truly flies in the face of so much that so many believe. If it is, well, let me ask you this. Let's take a look at some of the places that you actually went to study, to consider, to advance your argument. Because your book, in many ways, it's an argument. It's an argument that says,
yes,
whatever you've been believing, it's time for you to sort of move away from that and look at what's really true.
Well, at least consider that you might have been wrong. That's all I ask people. It's what I ask my students and my readers. It's okay if you have your opinion, but as they say, it's not okay to have your own facts.
Well, and we do know that so many of us, and certainly in this country and in many countries, survive and thrive, we believe, on the facts as we create them, which as
that's great. Well, very well said.
All right. Let's talk about some of the studies that you go into in sort of the beginning of your document. And it really is, your book is sort of it's a written documentary. That's sort of the response that I had to it. Let's talk about some of those early studies that you talk about in terms of the ways in which sex and sexuality and gender experiences happen throughout the world. You talk in one about one part of your book about a group of people that were studied in the Dominican Republic, and they had some interesting sexual experiences.
Yes, that group is a prime example of the power of the biology of the sexes that interacts in a very special way with their culture. So you have basically a genetic mutation which through process that is kind of technical and that we don't have to go into causes a certain small number of girls who are born, that is, they're born looking like girls, but it turns out that they are genetically male mostly, and when the other girls start going through puberty, these girls don't. They don't. The girls, as you know, go through puberty earlier, and they don't. For openers, they don't start developing breasts, and then they start later going through many aspects of male puberty. So, their shoulders broaden, their muscle mass increases. They don't deposit body fat like they would if they were developing into women, and they have a great enlargement of what was thought to be their clitoris, and it becomes a penis. And these girls go through a pubertal transformation that turns them into boys.
And all right. Now you know that there are people listening right now, and they're scratching their heads in disbelief.
I don't blame them one bit. Every scientist that knew anything about gender development did the same thing when the research started to first come out in the late 1970s, and the studies have been done, you know, to the nth degree. They're easy to find online. If you just Google Dominican Republic pseudo-hermaphrodites, that's what they're called. They're not true hermaphrodites because that's a very rare condition where someone has both ovaries and testes. But it's not that they're pretending. It's there. That's what they're called.
Okay.
Or you can look up Dominican sex change, and you probably find all the information you need. But the thing is that they adjust, and so they've been brought up. What's the main point here? The take home is that they've been brought up as girls, and they adjust to becoming men. And you know that they have some issues like fertility problems, but physicians have helped them with that. And but otherwise, you know, they get married. Almost all of them, they have had families. They've been men of their culture. And granted, it's a macho culture, so maybe it's easier to make the transition to becoming a man since it's a society that favors men. But where is the huge impact we would have expected to see from these kids being raised as girls? Why there's in one study there were 18 cases and one of them did not make an effective transition to becoming male. Why weren't they all totally confused?
Exactly.
Why weren't they all having gender identity problems throughout their lives? The reason is that they were exposed. The most likely explanation: they were exposed to testosterone. Their brains were exposed to testosterone before they were born, as every normal male is.
Okay.
And that prepared them for ultimately a masculine identity.
It's a fascinating reality. I was about to say it's a fascinating story, but this is not a story. This is, in fact, documented reality. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk more about, because you spend a lot of time early on talking about the various ways in which biology not culture, has such a huge impact on how we experience ourselves as male or female or other. So we will come back to this conversation right after the break. Folks, my name is Pamela Brewer, having a conversation with Dr. Melvin Connor, who is author of Women After All, Sex Evolution and the End of Male Supremacy. After you've fainted, relax. We'll be right back. Hi, folks. This is Pamela Brewer welcoming you back to Mind Talk. I'm going to quote today's guest. He says, "I am a man making an unrepentant argument that women are, on average and in aggregate, better than men." All right, Mel. Again, throughout this book, you really document the ways in which women, the ways in which we need to revisit how we as a society think about men and women. Why spend so much time early on in your book talking about the different ways in which male and female behaviors, both with animals as well as with humans, why spend so much time talking about that and giving us examples?
Well, first of all, to show that they're looking around the animal world, that there's a tremendous variety of sexual arrangements, and that the one we're familiar with in the human species is only one among many. And for example, I think it's fascinating to look at certain birds like the cassowary of Australia, where these are human-sized, very dangerous birds you don't want to get into an encounter with. But it turns out that the dangerous sex is the females. Hmm. And they are substantially bigger than the males, and they fight. They fight with each other in order to collect a harem of males. Hmm. They then lay their eggs, in those various males' nests, and the males spend about 9 months raising the young without the female being anywhere near around, because she's off making her next conquest and capturing the attention of another male who's going to be daddy to her next bunch of eggs.
And you're saying these are
one among many examples of natural adaptation in the animal world that's the opposite of the way we like to think it has to be.
And you say these birds are human-sized.
Well, the females are.
The females are. Okay, so that sounds pretty scary.
Males are little.
That sounds kind of scary for anybody to run up against. Give us some more examples. I know one point you talk about the flatworms. I think it's the red flatworm you talk about.
Yes, they're hermaphroditic, and they have fencing with their penises. So both of the individuals who are mating have penises, and they battle it out by fencing with their penises, and then try to stick each one tries to stick the penis in the other, and thereby depositing sperm that will fertilize the other one's eggs. And theoretically, whichever one does that first gets to go off and not be pregnant and try to do it again.
Interesting.
But both of the individuals who are in the mating game or the mating battle, it's basically a battle between the sexes, but without the sexes, since both sexes can be either male or female.
And you know, the idea of battling penises, if you will, quite frankly, I mean, that's something that occurs, I would suggest, in the human population often as well. Perhaps not in the same way as the flatworms, who actually have penises and they actually fight each other with their penises.
Right. Well, certainly ever since Freud, if not before, we've had an idea that there's an awful lot of symbolic penis fencing among human males, even if they're not actually doing it anatomically. And so getting back to humans, so what are humans really like? Well, I've said that males have, for biological reasons, a greater tendency to physical aggression and to kind of unbridled sexuality. And they, when I say that women in the book, that women are on average and in aggregate better than men, I mean something specific. I mean, if you think that the physical violence and hypersexuality that hurts, either of which hurts people a lot, mm-hmm. including sometimes people you're supposed to love.
Mm-hmm.
If you think that's bad, then why can't I say that the sex that has far, far more of those things is not as good as the sex that has so much less of those things? That's my argument. That's my rationale. Not some sort of, you know, arbitrary statement that women are better. It's certainly not a statement about women being ethereal and spiritual and, you know, how they should be kept out of the fray of everyday life, which is what a lot of men have said and thought when they talked about the, quote, superiority of women. That's not what I mean. I mean women should have more of a role in everyday life, in the fray, in the competition, in the opportunities for governing, for being executives in corporations, for legislating, for anything that women have been traditionally excluded from. They are getting into those things, and they need to get into them at a faster rate. And I predict it's going to happen. It's irreversible, and the world will be better for it.
It's irreversible, and it is going to happen. So, you know, what it sounds like is that there, from the beginning of time almost, there was a part of the human experience that perhaps out of its insecurity, perhaps out of its not knowing, decided that the strength and the power attached to men, and that women were less than. Not that they necessarily believed that women were less than, but perhaps out of a sense of insecurity and maybe genuinely not knowing. Is that possible?
Yes, definitely. I would only have a friendly amendment to what you said, which is it's not the beginning of time when this starts. You know, if you think of the human species whole history, most of it took place when our ancestors were hunting and gathering for a living. And so one of my big experiences that motivated me to write about this, think about it, was my 2 years among the Bushmen hunter-gatherers of Botswana in Africa. And what you saw there, and in lots of other hunting and gathering societies, it's not that the men wouldn't like to control women and exclude them. You know, men are men everywhere. and the battle of the sexes, as far as I'm concerned, rages in every culture. But in that kind of culture, you have a small face-to-face society where there's not a professional army, a professional priesthood, a professional merchant class. Mm-hmm. There's too few people for that kind of thing, and so what you get is all the decisions that have to be made are made sitting around the fire. At night, I like to say that based on what I saw, you could think of the whole of human evolution as one endless encounter group with people sitting around the fire for hours every night talking about everything, and women as well as men, because they were there. They couldn't be excluded. There's a small band of 30 or 40 people. The adults of both sexes in the band would be gathering to air their views of whether the band should move to find more game over there, or whether there were more plant foods over here, or whether some couple should get married or get divorced, or a thousand other things, and women were part of it. Women's voices were part of it. I mean, how stupid would it be for you to be in a society that's living on the on the edge in many ways, and exclude half the intelligence and half the suggestions and half the talent. So why did that eventually change? Well, basically, at the end of that part of human history, mm-hmm. we settled down and invented agriculture and invented cities and very large, dense populations. And that's when you have these specialized hierarchies, male priesthood, a male, mm-hmm. male merchant class, a male army, male nobility and political class, bureaucracy. And they were a critical mass of men who basically conspired to exclude women. So that has been true for 10 or 12,000 years, as anthropologists and archaeologists and historians see it now. So what happened over the last two centuries is really interesting. That is, why did women start to succeed in chipping away at this?
Right.
Beginning with the suffragist movement, the movement to get women to vote about 150 years ago, that I think was motivated by the rise of democracy, by the opposition to other kinds of unfairness, the end of slavery in the world, at least the advanced world, and even in the United States, the other thing that's happening is technology was gradually replacing male muscle,
uh-huh.
and the less women had to rely on men's muscular strength, which admittedly is greater if you want to look for male superiority, find it there. But when technology made male strength matter less and less and less, then the old arrangement mattered much less.
What it sounds like what you're saying, and we'll pick it up at on the other side of the break, it sounds like what you're saying is that the more advanced we became as a society, the less necessary men became. We'll talk about this on the other side of the break.
Certainly less necessary male supremacy became.
Okay. All right. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. Stay right where you are. We will continue the conversation with Dr. Mel Connor, author of Women After All, Sex Evolution, and the End of Male Supremacy. We'll be right back.
Hi, folks. This is Pamela Brewer, continuing the conversation with Dr. Melvin Connor. Mel, before the break, you were talking about, and I raised the issue of whether or not it is true that as society becomes, quote-unquote, more advanced, that there is less of a, I'll put need in quotes, for men. And let's talk about that, because on some levels, that kind of sounds like what you're saying. In fact, there's a point in your book where you say that we need to figure out where males come from, why they are the way they are, and whether they're really necessary, and how they can be managed if, as is likely, women decide to keep them around. So none of this is sounding really great for the male side of the species.
Right.
I mean,
first of all, although I have three daughters, I also have a son. I have a grandson and a granddaughter on the way. I want life to be good for all of them. Being a man, I feel like I have some value in this world, and I think we all have something to contribute. I play with the idea in the book of, you know, what it would be like to consider the elimination of men, not by some kind of violent means, but, you know, I think that it will be possible for two women to reproduce together biologically long before it's possible for two men to do it without the help of a woman who lends them a womb for 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
So you could imagine a world in which women are taking advantage of some new reproductive technology, and they would by the way only have girl babies through that technology, and so girls might become more numerous and women eventually too. It would then be more or less up to women if they want to keep men in the picture, or how much they want to do that. And I think that so there's a little bit of a joking aspect to my proposal about the elimination of men.
I think there are probably some men listening who don't think it's very funny or a joke at all. I mean, you're saying some pretty serious stuff.
Well, I at this point, I think of what the great suffragist leader Elizabeth Cady Stanton said way back in 1869, in one of her beautiful speeches, she talked about all the terrible things that men have done in history, and made a series of arguments for why women should have the vote and be in public life, and she said, just like you gave the vote to men who didn't own land and male immigrants, and now you've given the vote to former male slaves. All the arguments in favor of doing those things, the arguments about fairness and equality, also apply to giving women the vote. But one argument applies more strongly than all, and that, she says, is the difference of man and woman, as she puts it, the difference between men and women. And she says, because men and women are different, we need both to have a complete and whole society and government and leadership. And I feel like that's the most logical goal. But for so long, men have not recognized that.
Yeah.
And finally, most men are starting to. And women are starting to get the opportunities they deserve and have always deserved. And as I say, I think it's an irreversible trend. And I think the result is going to be very positive. I do have to wonder whether it's going to stop at 50-50. You know, so mm-hmm. there are 20 women in the Senate right now. Is there going to be some kind of magical switch that turns that? It's gone from zero to from 1 to 20 mm-hmm. since 1985. That's 30 years. And it's going to keep going. And is there going to be some sort of magical switch that turns it off at 50? So it always stays, you know. I don't know. One of the reasons I don't know is because we've seen in education, which is, you know, I'm a college professor. Mm-hmm. You look at high school graduation rates; it's majority female
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
Gone from majority male mm-hmm. to majority female in a very short time.
It has.
And it's still increasing. And, you know, college entrance, there's evidence that college admissions committees are now doing a kind of affirmative action for male applicants in order to not have the entering class mm-hmm. be too imbalanced toward women. But the those last statistics I saw are that the college entrance in the United States is 58% women,
mm.
and college graduates are 65% women.
Wow.
So what does that tell you? Well, first of all,
yeah.
it tells you that women do better in high school. Second, mm-hmm. it tells you that women have more educational ambition. And finally, it tells you that they're doing better in college once you let them in. They're graduating college at higher rates than they're entering college, and those numbers, if those numbers keep going, then the pool of educated people in the Western countries, in mm-hmm. the United States and other advanced countries, the pool of talent and educated talent is going to be increasingly female.
Well, that would certainly be a transition. It's a transition that's already occurring. You know, there's another piece to your book, which I actually appreciate. On the one hand, you know, we're talking about the fact that women just have perhaps different skills that allow them to do more and be more than they have been portrayed as in the past. But the other point that you make, just in terms of the male-female piece, you know, you say that there are many cultures that have a third gender, some have more, and you suggest that we don't try to force people to choose between being male or female. Yeah, that's where most people show up, but if we don't try to force that, that in fact we could live in a happier world, and maybe we could focus more on each individual's individual gift that they bring to the world rather than whether or not he or she is a man or a woman, and is this a manly thing to do or a womanly thing to do.
Yes, well, I completely agree with that, Pamela, and I think some cultures are better at this than we are, although we're learning a lot about it. I mean, I've had the amazing experience of of watching a young girl I saw grow up from birth, and recently in her 20s decided to become a man and has made a remarkable transition psychologically. Mm-hmm. She's one of those people who never felt like a girl.
Mm-hmm.
She always felt like a boy, and she got older like a man, and she seems to be very happy. It is you know, the statistics show that it's a somewhat risky thing to do psychologically, but that's partly because there's so much prejudice
yeah.
against people who do that. I don't think that you're going to see millions of people making choices like that.
Right.
I think you're going to see a very small percentage, and that they should be, that our society would be better off if people like that are allowed to make their choices. I think you do see millions who are who are not wanting to change their gender, but who are wanting to choose who they love, mm-hmm. As someone of the same gender. And that is, we're seeing, there are millions of people like that, and we are seeing a revolution right now in our country in the acceptance of gay and lesbian marriage. And I think that's a great thing. I think that my book is directed mainly at, you know, what's called the heteronormative majority.
Mm-hmm.
Where I see tremendous advantages to be gained if more women more men are in power, or if at least the power balance is more equal, and it doesn't matter whether the women who become legislators and executives and even president and heads of nations are gay or straight.
Mm-hmm.
I still think that they're going to contribute something that will be different from, and in some ways better than, what men contribute.
Well, you somewhere in the book, I mean, you certainly make the observation that I think many people would agree with, that women as a whole are more likely to look to problem solve using logic, using collaborative techniques, using negotiations, are less likely to want to pick up a gun or a knife and go to war, and more likely to try to find a solution that doesn't involve killing people.
Yes, it's not like I don't think that women are ever violent. I
mm-hmm.
just think if you look at the statistics, there's a huge difference between women and men in these tendencies. And it's not like I don't think women are ever corrupt or egotistical or,
sure.
or aggressive in non-physical ways. On the contrary, we know many examples. But on average, women are going to be less on a hair trigger of
uh-huh.
of violence, and less
yeah.
on the potential to be distracted by inappropriate sexual impulses and emotions
than men. Folks, we're going to take
yes.
a break, and when we come back, we will continue what I think is a really interesting conversation with Dr. Melvin Connor, author of Women After All, Sex Evolution, and the End of Male Supremacy. We'll be right back. Dr. Connor, we were talking about this just before the break. I'd like to go back to it for a moment. When you talk about the ways in which we tend to try to put people in either the male box or the female box, and they are boxes. You make the point that parents can almost accept a child who is a criminal more easily than a transgendered child. And again, it just sort of brings me back to what we've been talking about in a lot of ways all along, which is the value of seeing people as individuals, not as genders,
it seems to be the way to go. It seems to be a way that everybody gets to play the role that they're good at playing in our society.
Well, I think that's perfectly fair, and I would like to see a world where gender blindness works well for everybody. But I think we've learned from you know the political concept of color blindness that really isn't good enough in a world that's recovering from a horrible repression of one group of people by another on the basis of color. So in that situation, color blindness becomes a way of preserving the status quo.
Yeah. Okay.
And not righting the wrongs of the past. So if I could just, you know, use the same analogy, the same principle with women and men. I mean, women have been in the press class for thousands of years. Men have, and everyone really until pretty recently, have taken it for granted that men have to run everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're ready for gender blindness yet.
Do
you see what I mean?
I don't think we're ready to
just say, well, we just have to stop discriminating against women and everything will be okay. I think we still need a long course of affirmative action and a recognition of the separate special value of women.
Well, you talk throughout the book about all the ways in which women are superior. You said biologically they're more resilient. Psychologically, they certainly approach things perhaps from a broader perspective. You quote, I think it's some research you quote that says that girls, as they get older, tend to want to associate with women, whereas boys, as they get older, tend to want to associate with their peers. So, I mean, there just seem to be all kinds of ways in which women have lots and lots to offer that has been ignored, denied, or hidden or lied about. So where does that leave men? Anywhere? Should they just stay home?
Well, I mean, it might be, you know, it might be a nice rest for a lot of us if we sort of stay home and retire from the fray for a while. I mean, actually, my daughter is an attorney in town. She actually went to NYU, where I think you graduated from.
Yes.
And her husband is a stay-at-home dad, and he's a member of a group of stay-at-home dads.
Okay.
All very devoted, and he's probably the best father I've ever seen. And she's a great mom, too, but I think men have a lot to gain from having certain aspects of what were traditionally women's roles open to us, because those can be very rewarding to us too. And go back to the question of how women do things differently when they do have power. I love the example of the budget crisis of the end of 2013, when the government was essentially shut down, and male senators are sitting, with their arms folded over their chest, glaring at each other across the aisle. And one day, some Republican women decided to reach out to some Democratic women, and pretty soon, you know, they had a flurry of emails and texting and got together and sat down and hammered out a deal, which they then called men in on. Mm-hmm. This is now a minority of the Senate. It's only 20 women in the Senate, that they pioneered this deal, which the men then signed on to. One of the men was John McCain, who's been in the Senate for decades.
Indeed.
And he said, you know, he said kind of jokingly, the women are taking over. And whether that's true or not, that was his way of acknowledging that they made this deal.
Right.
That opened up the United States government again, and then followed them in mm-hmm. this. And I think there are a lot of studies of women executives, women mayors, and other women leaders that suggest that we will see more of that as women get more influence.
So the takeaway, if you will, for folks reading this book, what do you want folks to walk away with?
Well, I want people of both sexes to see that, first of all, we've had a long history of male supremacy that has done a lot of damage. In some ways, the majority of men have been victims of male supremacy, as much as or even more than women. And women have unique characteristics which go beyond our upbringing, and that men have unique characteristics which are in some ways less admirable, mainly in the sex and violence area, and that we will all benefit if the trend toward greater participation by women, greater leadership by women, continues and intensifies.
But, you know, and any time there's a situation in which the group, particularly if it's a minority group, when I say minority, I mean in terms of numbers, overall numbers, if it's a group that is in power, whether it's a racial group or gender or sexual orientation, whatever it is, when that sense of power is disturbed, that group fights even more to hold on. You know, I'm certainly thinking about all the people who were killed as we fought and continue to fight for racial equality in this country. I think certainly about women who have been harmed as there have been fights for women to have more power. I think about all the horrific things that have been said and done and folks who have been killed in one way or another as the sexual equality is on the table. What's going to stop that kind of madness from occurring now, as you talk about the fact that women really need to, there needs to be a shift in terms of male and female power?
So, great question, and unfortunately nothing's going to stop it completely. It's unfolding before our eyes on a very small minor scale. I've had excerpts from the book published in the Wall Street Journal and Slate.com and elsewhere, and the blowback from some men has been very nasty and really confirms my worst suspicions about what some men are like.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of insecure men out there, it's fair for them to be insecure to some extent. It's fair for us to be concerned, for example, about boys doing poorly in school, compared to girls. And I think we have to keep aware of that. And we also have to be vigilant about these men who are basically throwbacks to a past that we need to put behind us. Mm-hmm. And you see that in Boko Haram, you see it in ISIS, you mm-hmm. see it in Pakistan, the Taliban, and in Afghanistan, elsewhere in the world where girls are getting an education for the first time, you see men
absolutely
being frightened by it and becoming violent over it. You see them burning down girls' schools. You see them throwing acid in girls' faces and shooting them. Malala Yousafzai, who was shot a couple of years ago because she was advocating education for girls, and now she's the youngest person to ever win the Nobel Peace Prize. These guys tried to kill her, and it kind of backfired a little because she became someone who could continue to spearhead the effort to get more and more girls educated throughout the world. That's where yes, they're going to react, and they are reacting, but most men are more accepting, men like me who have daughters and who want the best for their daughters and granddaughters have always been willing to sympathize with women's rights and the advancement of women. And so it might be it might be two steps forward and one step back. It might, more likely, I would say, you know, five steps forward and one step back.
Okay.
But there'll be the steps backward. Some of them will be nasty, and but they won't. I don't think they're capable of reversing the trend.
Okay. It's here, and it's here to stay and grow. Dr. Melvin Connor, author of Women After All, Sex, Evolution, and the End of Male Supremacy, thank you so much for your book, for your work, and for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer. I appreciate so much your having me on. I thought the conversation was very, very nice.
Thank you, as did I. And thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to take the place of any work you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, send me an email to Pamela, Pamela, at mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.ORG. And folks, you remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.